focus this weekend or for these few days is really in on these three texts of Wangchuk Dorje, the ninth Karmapa, and then a few references to other things that you, many of you are more familiar with, Dujam Lingpa, etc. But these three texts of Wangchuk Dorje, these meditation manuals, are really all, almost all of them devoted to the practice of shamatha and vipassana. And this really is, so this is everything that you need to know about Mahamudra, remember. And so it's everything that you need to know is shamatha and vipassana. So shamatha, both of those are Sanskrit terms. And shamatha in years past was translated as calm abiding, tranquility, a few other English terms that connoted that. But calm abiding was very, very common. And you still see, actually, Trangu Rinpoche's translators. In each of these three texts that I have been reading, he had a different translator. And so some of the terms are, they're quite different, even, the topic headings and descriptions and all that. But still uses tranquility a lot. But Lama Allen, who's a really terrific translator and has been for 40 years or so, the first translator for the Dalai Lama in the West, says that for these familiar Sanskrit terms, bodhicitta, do you really need to translate that into mind of enlightenment or enlightenment mind? And shamatha and vipassana, now like that also, they're so familiar in the West that, or they're common, so that it makes a lot more sense just to use the Sanskrit terms rather than to just try to translate them into some English approximation that doesn't really get it. So it just makes more sense to talk about shamatha and then define it. What does that mean? And then just use the term shamatha. And then you have this rich base of association that isn't limited by a misleading or, incomplete anyway, English term. And so shamatha and vipassana, these two Sanskrit terms. So shamatha is all about developing single-pointedness, stability. And remember, that is ethically neutral. So even a bank robber or an assassin or, somebody who is doing something horrific could be single-pointedly focused on what they're doing. And, that's not really what we're after. But shamatha, again, so it really depends on your motivation while doing this and recognizing that this is a really important integrated part of this whole path of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, where it is really emphasized in both these two traditions. And vipassana, then, the Sanskrit term vipassana, is often translated as insight. And so this is where you're really beginning to do wisdom practices, where you're really, the whole point of shamatha is to develop stability, this balance of stability and clarity, but it is leading to the point of single-pointedness. The state of shamatha is a state of non-conceptual single-pointedness, a total absence of distraction, total absence of laxity or dullness, but it is just this very brilliant, luminous stillness that is non-conceptual. And so that is that state. But then that is just the beginning, really, of this whole progression of practice in Mahamudra, because as I'll point out and emphasize when we get to Vipassana practice, if that's all you're doing is shamatha practice, if all of your meditation practice, and you see this, I think, in contemporary meditation approaches, really, that a lot of meditation is all about relaxation, or, you know, and to eliminate the distractions so that you can relax, to eliminate the chattering mind, all the worries, you know, and the troubles, so that you can focus on something, a calming image or something like that. So Dujom Lingpa points out, and all the Mahamudra masters point out, that if that's all you're doing, you haven't advanced one hair's breadth towards liberation, even if you achieve shamatha. So vipassana is the other absolutely essential component of Mahamudra Dzogchen practice. And that is what really leads you then to cut through the kleshas, the mental afflictions, with wisdom. So you use the, in the beginning, shamatha is so important to develop and begin with shamatha, because our minds are so turbulent, and we can't possibly, even though the basic point of Mahamudra and Dzogchen is that our minds are already naturally liberated, but that natural state of the mind is obscured by this turbulence of all of our mental afflictions, our busyness, etc. And so the point of shamatha practice is to calm the mind, to eliminate those obscurations. And then we are able to, once we eliminate those obscurations, and we can really look at the mind clearly and in stillness, then we're able to really begin to do the work of vipassana practice, which is to look directly at the mind and come to know its nature. So the great yogi Milarepa said, meditating is not meditating on something. This is interesting, isn't it? Because all of us, a lot of us have come to, this has been our meditation practice. We're meditating, and you have a choice of things that you're meditating on. So what are you meditating on? I'm meditating on a stick or a stone or a flower. I'm meditating on the breath. I'm meditating on so-and-so. You know, what is your object of meditation? Milarepa said, meditation or meditating is not meditating on something. It is familiarizing yourself with your mind. So that's Mahamudra shamatha. You know, you're not, remember the object condition is not the stick or the stone or the flower or the breath. Those are just focal supports that are intended to promote and support non-distraction. But what you're really focused on, or what you're really, your object is this familiarizing yourself with your mind, the stillness of the mind, and the, you know, either the relative nature, you could say with shamatha, luminosity, non-conceptuality, or bliss, or the, you know, the whole big picture of when you cut through that and are resting truly in Mahamudra, primordial consciousness, pristine awareness. You know, that's what we are really trying to remain focused on then. And so we are familiarizing ourselves with our mind, or you are familiarizing yourself with your mind is a better way to put it. When you're doing meditation. So what is this mind? When we think of mind, really, when we think of our experience of mind, it is actually a limited part of consciousness or awareness. What our experience of mind in the Mahamudra and Dzogchen, and generally in Buddhist psychology, it's actually what we think of as mind is actually limited to the six consciousnesses, the six primary consciousnesses. And curiously, in Dzogchen, there are said to be eight of these primary consciousnesses. But generally, you know, you speak of six primary consciousnesses. The first five of these are the sense consciousnesses. So there's a sense consciousness associated with each of the sense faculties, the eye, the ear, the nose, taste, etc. So you have these, and tactile, so you have these five sense consciousnesses that are associated with the senses, and then you have the mental consciousness, which is associated with everything else, thinking primarily. So the five sense consciousnesses, it's important to recall and to recognize that these are non-conceptual, that there is no liking or disliking a visual image if you're looking at it directly, or a sound if you're hearing it directly. All that there is are these perceptions. So there's a big distinction between perception and conception. And so the job of the five sense consciousnesses is to supply perception. And then, of course, what happens is that gets conceptually elaborated instantly. There are actually two separate, there's a process that as you develop shamatha practice, you can actually watch and know the distinction between perception and conception. But what happens very quickly is that the conception gets projected back by the sixth consciousness, the mental consciousness, back out onto the perception. And we come to believe then that the conception is actually what I am perceiving out there as an external object. And this is the way that we experience the external world. Primarily, if you're not training the mind anyway, is that we are the mental consciousness is totally confused in believing that the conception that is it is projecting onto a sense impression actually exists out there external and independent of the mind. And then that projected conception becomes the basis for liking and disliking, for attachment and aversion, and for all of the behaviors then that are creating karma. It's all based on that fundamental delusion that the conception of the mental consciousness actually exists out there as an external object. And so what we are trying to do with our shamatha practice is to disentangle that and to actually watch the process and recognize that the sense consciousnesses actually to have non-conceptual experiences of sense perception. And then to watch or to recognize the conceptual projection in real time as it's happening. And then just to recognize that, oh, what I know what I identify, what typically so conceptuality is the specialty of mental consciousness, of the sixth consciousness. And it typically conflates a term, an identity, a definition, an abstraction of the mental appearance, sensory appearance. It conflates the abstraction, projects it out onto that, and oftentimes that is actually as a term, you know, an English term that we're using. So cup, you know, well, sort of, travel mug, insulated travel mug. You know, it takes a little different word, because if I said, Jarrett, will you please go get my cup? You know, he might think that, oh, I'm talking about one of those porcelain ones out there. But if I said, Jarrett, will you please go get my travel mug? You know, that then in his mind is, oh, that's this thing, the silver one with the lid that's supposed to be spill-proof and keep everything hot for 16 hours. So that basically is what we're beginning to disentangle with shamatha. So what's really interesting and powerful, I think, about these Mahamudra practices of shamatha is that you begin to disentangle that right away by observation, just by direct observation of what's going on in your mind, without even doing the bringing the nature the analysis of the nature of the perception of the mind into play yet. So you can really begin to loosen that grip of and the grasping of mental consciousness, and simply by with the techniques of observation of shamatha practice. Okay, this is the big picture here, or the really the most important point of the big picture. We can identify the conceptuality that we are projecting, that mental consciousness is projecting onto sense impressions. We can come to know that as distinctly and distinguish that as mental activity from perceptual activity, right? Okay, so remember going back now to yesterday's our motivation, and especially these four special conditions that are imbuing our practice. So the first of these, the causal condition, what is that? Revulsion or disillusionment with samsara. So what is samsara? This is what is really, if we're going to be disillusioned with it, you know, we ought to really know what this is, to have a very clear idea of what it is that we're supposed to be transcending, what it is that we're going to be seeing through. So this is really one of the most concise and precise definitions and very helpful definitions that I have encountered in this. And this is really goes right to the heart. This is distinctly Mahamudra Dzogchen. And this is from Gyatro Rinpoche's, who's Lama Ellen Dzogchen Lama, his commentary actually into a great citation in the text, Mahamudra text, Spacious Path to Freedom. So he says, enlightenment is nothing other than the nature of your own mind. Do not look elsewhere. A mind imbued with conceptual elaboration is a mind of samsara. There you have it. I mean, if you can really remember that this is what we are trying to see through and to cut through, is really this entanglement of the conceptual projection of the mental consciousness onto so-called external sense perceptions and conflating them into an object, a thing that exists out there with qualities that, especially it exists with qualities that could only come from my mind, but I see them as existing with qualities that are likable or unlikable, you know, repugnant, or I crave them. And so I have to do something about that object, and it all becomes then my happiness. Then if I am mistaken in that way, my happiness then just becomes about managing all of these external objects that I have. I have to have the right ones, and I have to get rid of the wrong ones in my life. And if I get the right collection of things, external objects, you know, and it can't, you know, then I'm going to be happy. And that is the progress, that is my path to happiness, is managing all these delusory appearances out there that seem to exist, external of the mind. So what he's saying is that the conceptual projection is samsara. A mind free of conceptual elaboration is liberated. The very nature of the mind itself is primordially, intrinsically free from conceptual elaboration. So the natural state of the mind is free of conceptual elaboration. And so this is the great promise, and this is why the path is all about discovering the natural state and eliminating that which obscures the natural state. Consequently, when we abide in that state, we are abiding in the essential nature of the mind. That is nirvana. So there you have it. Samsara and nirvana, conceptuality and absence of conceptual elaboration. And so that is the what we are going to try to access during this brief time together, this non-conceptual state. And this is called stillness in Mahamudra, the state where the mind is not moving in conceptuality, but you're resting in this non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. And that's what the point of shamatha practice is. So this natural state of the mind, the essential nature of the mind that Gyatso Rinpoche is referring to, is a state of luminous cognizance. It's hyphenated. So it's not it's not a modifier. It's not luminous modifying cognizance. It's hyphenated. It's luminous cognizance. So that these are two separate things, but you hyphenate them to show that it's one thing. So non-dual, two sides of the same coin, luminous cognizance. Trangu Rinpoche's translators also often use the term lucidity cognizance, which is cool because lucidity has special connotation for students of Lama Allen Wallace, that it really refers to lucid dreaming, and then how lucid dreaming, knowing that you're dreaming when you're dreaming, and then being able to manipulate those dream images in the lucid state of dreaming, really becomes your way of understanding what the difference between just realizing emptiness and realizing rikpa. It's lucidity. And so anyway, I like this lucidity hyphen cognizance, but it basically means luminosity cognizance, or luminosity emptiness refers to something a little bit different. But the luminosity here refers to the mind's capacity to know and to experience. So it is not an image or a visualization of the sun coming up over the horizon. Although light is a very powerful metaphor, and yogis describe the luminous state of the mind as this brightness, So it's not totally to be rejected, but that's not the point. The luminous is just like the light in a dark room that is able to make things knowable when the light is turned on. And so the luminous quality is like the light that makes all appearances knowable. And then the cognizance is the capacity actually to know what has been illuminated. So it has this dual, non-dual qualities or characteristics that are the defining characteristics of awareness. And so to experience the luminous cognizance or the lucidity cognizance that is the natural state of the mind, we train mental consciousness, the sixth consciousness, with shamatha practice. So Mahamudra really emphasizes that we're training the sixth consciousness with shamatha practice. And this is exactly the consciousness that is creating all the problems. So we're training the mental consciousness that is causing the problem, and then it is going to become, basically, it's the mental consciousness also has the capacity to be non-conceptual. And so that's exactly what we're trying to do with that. And then I mentioned the seventh and eighth primary consciousnesses in Mahamudra. I've never seen this in other places. But the seventh consciousness is what Lama Allen translates as Klishtamanas. So some of you have had long teachings on that. And then the eighth, would be substrate consciousness. But Trungpa Rinpoche says those are really not involved in development of shamatha, interestingly. So I think there's just a little difference in approach in Dzogchen and Mahamudra on that. But anyway, Mahamudra really emphasizes that it's this sixth consciousness that we are training. And what we're doing is training the mind to eliminate the conceptual screen that prevents us from seeing the natural state of the mind. And so to do that, Karma Chagme then emphasized in his text, Naked Awareness, that this awareness of luminosity and cognizance is always going to occur in the present moment. And he said, this unstructured consciousness of the present, the instant that is free of mental engagement, is called Mahamudra. So we're really beginning to get quite, I think, experientially precise now about what it is that we're trying to do. It's present moment experience. And so in the beginning, when we are trying to rest in this non-conceptual state, to get to this point, we're going to rely on some techniques to begin with. And this is from Padmasambhava's Natural Liberation. In that way, until genuine shamatha arises in your mind stream, use numerous techniques to settle your mind in its natural state. As an analogy, if you wish to look at reflections in the planets and stars in a pool of water, they will not be seen where the water is disturbed by waves and ripples, the turbulence of the mind. You're not going to see the nature of the mind if the mind is turbulent. So you have to make it still and calm so it's able to reflect even the stars, like a pool of water. But they are clearly seen by looking into a pool in which the water is lucid and still. Likewise, when the mind is jolted around by the wind of objects, you can think of, again, the terminology is just so precise here. Objects are referring to that conflation of conceptual and perceptual that we take to be external objects. So when the mind is jolted around by the wind of objects, like a rider on a bucking bronco, even if you are introduced to pristine awareness, you will not identify it. For once the mind is helplessly manipulated by compulsive ideation, it does not see its own nature. So there you have it. We have the nature of cognitive lucidity or lucid cognizance. It's there to be discovered, but we can't perceive it, we can't come to know it because our minds are so turbulent. And so the point of shamatha practice is to calm the waters. And so just as years ago when I was building with Adobe in Arizona and we were looking for a local site that we could use for material to make Adobe bricks. It's a very precise ratio of clay, sand, and fines. And so when you have this particular ratio right, then your bricks are going to hold together, they're not going to crack, and they become good building materials. And so the way that you do that is you just sample some earth, put it into a big jar of water, shake it up, and then let it sit for a couple of hours, come back, and you see everything stratified. You see the sand would be on the bottom, and the clay would be in the middle, and then the fines right on top, but perfectly stratified so you can see the proportion. And what's on top of that? Clear water. So what had been totally muddy that you couldn't even see through, all you do is let it settle in its natural state. And all of the impurities settle out and you're left with water. So that's what we are trying to do with our shamatha practice. And so we begin with techniques for doing that. So that's what we're going to get into now, is really the techniques. And the ninth Karmapa begins his excursion into these techniques by discussing points of the body. So there are points of the body and points of the mind. And really, you probably know already everything that that's really important to know about the points of the body. There are, you know, there's the 7-point posture of Vairochana, but it's a little bit, those 7 points are a little bit different, and then there are 5 points of Talopa, etc. But the 7 points in Mahamudra are a little bit different, but I don't think we're going to go into those precise points about the arms and the shoulders and all of that. The most important point that is emphasized is that it has to be comfortable. So you have to be able to relax, you have to be comfortable, because you want to be able to maintain this posture for longer periods of time, so that without fidgeting, without discomfort, because that becomes a real distraction if your body is uncomfortable. You would like to just forget about your body. And so then, you know, we discuss these 4 postures that you have, really 3 in this retreat, unless you want to do walking meditation. But 3 you can really do in this room here. You know, the supine or shavasana, the seated position, and then standing position. And don't forget standing position. If you're, you know, by the 3rd ghataka this morning, if you're feeling lax, you know, and you're beginning to feel that you need some stimulation, even that seated position isn't providing, just stand up, you know, and you'll really, really feel a dramatic difference. And then the points of the mind. So pretty simple. I mean, there is a long discussion about these points of the body, but we'll skip past those because we don't have weeks and weeks to go into it. But the points of the mind, that's where really most of the discussion is. And so there are general points of the mind, and then there are specific points of the mind. And here is the general point of the mind. Basically, all shamatha or Mahamudra shamatha techniques and the advice about the mind is an elaboration of this basic point. Do not prolong the past. Do not beckon the future. Rest evenly in luminous cognizance that is without conceptualization. So that is the general point of the mind. So that's exactly what we're trying to do. So we don't prolong the past. What does that mean? We don't beckon the future. What does that mean? Well, the really obvious meaning of that, and the most common way of understanding that, is that you don't let your mind go off to the past or the future. Because, you know, so in memory and rumination about something that happened in the past, and of course this happens a lot in longer retreats, you know, everything that you've ever done kind of that you had no idea had even left a memory all of a sudden pops up. But that doesn't have to be taking you to the past. You can still be, that doesn't mean that images of the past, mental images of the past, aren't going to arise, but you don't go following them into the past. Basically, your viewing of mental activity, it remains in the present. And because where is this actually happening, really? Are you traveling off to some past to relive the experience? Well, of course, it's all happening in the present moment. And it is just some facsimile of the past that is arising in the present moment. Same with when you are anticipating the future. You know, you're not time traveling, to something that hasn't been created yet. What you're doing is just in the present moment, entertaining scenarios, and you can become so attached to them, so identified with them, that you lose the present moment and you become, you go wandering with these to the future, and you forget all about what actually is happening, that these are simply mental appearances arising in the present moment. So what we are trying to do is to not let the mind wander off to the future or the past, but to remain in the present. So that's the common way. It makes total sense, right? I mean, that's really, really easy to grasp. Dzogchen Ponlap Rinpoche had a more subtle explanation of that, which I think is really interesting also in his oral commentary on this point. And that is that don't prolong the past means don't grasp to the immediately preceding moment of awareness. Don't anticipate the future means don't grasp to the moment that is about to arise. So you're talking about the two adjacent moments of the present moment, really, the ones that would kind of in our imagination touch the present moment, like two cells or something like that. Although that is just obviously an inaccurate image, because the past and the future don't really exist. How do we know them? Simply as things that are happening in the present. So we are really, what he's saying is that what we want to do is just to rest in this present moment of awareness, because the mind is continually coming into existence and going out of existence. Awareness is moments of awareness are continually coming into existence and going out of existence. And so we want to always be in the fresh now. And Dzogchen Ponlap Rinpoche had this very cute device that makes it so easy to remember. And this would be a good tattoo. You know, this retreat's tattoo. Now, fresh. Now, fresh. Now, fresh. So you get the point that because we can become so obsessed, I think, as shamatha practitioners, with trying to develop stillness. And our idea of stillness is this moment that stretches, you know, from long periods. An entire session of stillness is just like one long moment, you know, and that what we're, and this is the goal of our shamatha practice, is to stretch these moments. Well, Dzogchen Ponlap Rinpoche emphasized that don't try to stretch the present moment. Don't try to get the past and the future to touch or to merge with the present, because these are really ephemeral moments that are just continually coming into existence and going out of existence. And so what you are doing, what basically the present moment is constantly resetting itself. And don't grasp. Don't say that, you know, don't try to turn it into something that it can't possibly be. So it's short increments repeatedly of awareness. This becomes really manageable then. This is, I think, illuminating, because we may have been trying to do something that just can't be done and shouldn't be done with this stretching of the present. And then sustaining moment-to-moment presence is meditation, another definition of meditation. So that's it, just sustaining moment-to-moment meditation or awareness. That's all we're doing in meditation. And then Gampopa said, We should not conceive of the present as anything. So again, don't conceptualize the present. When water is undisturbed, it is clear, he says. When mind is uncontrived, it is luminous. So that's all we're trying to do, is rest in this continually refreshing, fresh now, or now, fresh, over and over and over again. So that is those are the general points of the mind. So any shamatha practice that we're doing, whatever our object is, this is what we should keep in mind, these general points of the mind. And then there are the particular points of the mind. And this is really the bulk of the text. So this is where we get into the actual techniques now of Mahamudra Shamatha. And the basic framework for these techniques of Shamatha in these three texts of Mahamudra are, first of all, they're basically grouped into three categories of experience that form a progression. So that basically you start off with one, move to two, and then arrive at three. So the first of these is called settling the mind that has not settled. So the first group of shamatha techniques is all about getting the mind to settle that hasn't, you know, a mind that hasn't settled, you're getting the mind to settle. And then the second group of techniques is called stabilizing the mind that has settled. So you actually are able to settle the mind with the first group. Then you stabilize what has settled. And then the third group of techniques is enhancing the stabilization. So this is the basic framework for all of the techniques of shamatha. So we're going to start with settling the mind that has not settled. And in another text, the translator termed it getting hold of it when you have not gotten hold of it. So what you are getting hold of here, Trungpa Rinpoche says, is you are getting hold of what meditation really is. What is the experience of meditation? You're familiarizing yourself with the techniques, and you're really beginning to have some experience of what this non-conceptual state really is like. So this is getting hold of it, or settling the mind that hasn't settled. And the first group of techniques is all about that, really learning the basics of meditation and beginning to have some experience of what stillness is really all about. Really, when you look at all of these three categories, most of the techniques that we would call shamatha, that and we might be more familiar with as shamatha techniques, are all in this category. We're settling the mind that hasn't settled. And then the other two, there's really not, well, the third one is interesting, very interesting, but the first one is really what, you know, I think most of us would think of as techniques of shamatha. To get hold of the experience of meditation, there are three objects of focus, and you see this outlined in your handout. So first of all, there's concentrating on an object, concentrating without an object, and concentrating on the breath. So these are the three broad categories within, you know, learning the basic techniques of shamatha. And then the first of these, concentrating on an object, can be external or internal. And the external object can be either sacred or mundane. And we're going to return to that a little later this afternoon. So I won't go into that in much detail now, but that's concentrating on an object in front of you, the stick or the stone or the flower. Those would be mundane objects, or sacred object would be statue, tanka, you know, an image out in front of you. It's an object. but you're concentrating on that. And so that's, it basically does the same thing, but it's just a different object, one sacred, one mundane. And then the second is placing the mind without an object. And this one is really pretty specialized in that it really focuses on the disillusionment of the elements, the five elements. So you visualize the elements in particular geometrical shapes and colors, and then they dissolve into each other. And of course, this is a very important practice in certain Anuttara Tantra practices, like the sixth yoga of Vajrayogini, for instance. And also, this is what happens at death, is this disillusion of the elements. And so you can basically, the reason so those are obviously the visual appearances are objects, but what that leads then to is just like as within the sixth yoga of Vajrayogini, it leads you to resting in non-conceptuality. And so there's that. But we're not going to focus on that either. The one that I really want to work with this morning is the third focal support, which is resting the mind on the breath. So this is one that I think most of you are very familiar with. And you probably have your favorite breath meditations. So Lama Allen has taught these extensively and uses these as early phases of shamatha practice. And he draws these from the Theravadin tradition. He studied with a great Theravadin master in Sri Lanka for a time. And so he, integrates these, like the Burmese method of the abdomen, and then really the bread and butter for most people is the tactile sensations of the breath at the nose. So here what you're really focusing on is the tactile sensations that are experienced as the air enters and leaves your nostrils. And the ninth Karmapa says that you can, that's okay to use that image, or not image, but that tactile sensation. So basically your attention is being anchored by the movement of tactile sensations at the nose, but your attention doesn't move with the breath as it enters and leaves. Your breath remains stably fixed at the tip of the nose there. So there's that one that many of you are very familiar with, and it might be your favorite breath meditation or your favorite meditation, in fact. So this is that's probably the most common meditation that is taught, you know, around the world, would be that one. So here, though, the ninth Karmapa and all of the texts of Mahamudra that I've seen really emphasize a progression, a different progression. And so I'm going to give you that progression. And so you can just experiment with this and see whether you like it or not. You know, so Trungpa Rinpoche and Dzogchen Ponlop Rinpoche said, all of these techniques of shamatha, they basically are just giving you a smorgasbord of techniques, and you should experiment with them and see which ones really work for you. And then you probably want to specialize in that one for breath meditation anyway. And breath meditation is taught in all Buddhist traditions because it is the most effective object if your mind is really... if the thing that is really preventing you from single-pointed attention is the movement of the discursive mind. So if it's the turbulence of the discursive mind, breath meditation is the best of all the objects, possible objects. So almost everybody acknowledges that. And so probably for most contemporary people, that is the thing that prevents us from resting in single-pointedness right now, is that discursive movement of the mind, just constant turbulence. So breath meditation is extremely valuable. So here, the ninth Karmapa teaches a different progression of breath meditation. And I experimented with this over my winter retreat, and I fell in love with it. I experimented with all the techniques that he taught here. And so some, you know, I gave them a few days, and so some of them, like the elements, said, well, right now that doesn't feel like, you know, the thing for me. But this progression really, really did it. And it was, I thought, very extremely effective. So the progression begins with a practice. So there are, in the way that I'm going to do this, there are, in this progression that you can do in a single session, one single 24-minute session, there's a progression of five techniques. So the first of these techniques is called dispelling the stale air. And so this is one that you might do first thing in the morning, you know, and or the first, if you're doing, you know, periods of meditation, like you're in, let's say you're in retreat and you have your day blocked off, like I'm going to meditate for 2 hours before breakfast, and then another 2 hours before, you know, after breakfast, before lunch, and then another 3 hours or something in the afternoon, and et cetera, et cetera. So you might have these blocks of time. And so you might start every block of time then with the full progression. So the progression, dispelling the stale air, is all about getting rid of it. So the one thing to say about these first techniques, the first three techniques really, is that they are a really mild forms of pranayama. And, you know, so it's something that Lama Allen just doesn't teach, are these pranayamic approaches. But Mahamudra really emphasizes them. And I like them because there was a period when I was really drawn to pranayama and maybe went a little extreme with it. But, you know, so, and I gave it up for a while after that because of that. But now these are really, really gentle practices, and there's, you are only going to benefit from them, not hurt yourself with them. So the first of these is called dispelling the stale air, which is a 9-round breathing. And so you can visualize three channels in your body, that two side channels that start at the two nostrils. On the right is the red channel that starts at the nostril, goes up over the crown of the head, you know, underneath the skull, of course, and then down to below the navel, where it joins, there's a triple junction. It joins, first of all, the left white channel that starts at the left nostril and then comes down. So these then join in what's like a W. And then the central channel is connected to the two side channels. So in the first, what we're doing, expelling the stale air, we're expelling the, basically we start with expelling the stale air in the left nostril, which is on the white one. And you just very gently, you close off your right nostril. So just breathe in and gently, fully breathe out. And you can feel, with these pranayamas, I think it's very helpful to feel your diaphragm really going in and out. And this will be especially important with the next technique. But your diaphragm just goes out and then in. So you very gently take a full breath and then gently breathe out through the left nostril. And he says that you can visualize, and it's helpful to visualize, that you are eliminating the mental affliction and kind of what I think of as a plaque-like buildup in these channels of the mental affliction of attachment. And Mary Kay pointed out that Sultram Alioni points out that for women, it's probably different, that the left channel, white channel, is associated with attachment or craving rather than aversion rather than the craving. And so men, the white is craving and attachment, and the red is aversion and hostility. So you're basically expelling the stale air and these mental afflictions. The second route, and then you do basically three on each side. So you inhale again. And the second exhalation is a little more forceful. So you're getting what Trungpa Rinpoche says is the first one is you're getting the very coarse mental affliction of craving or aversion. The second, you're a little more subtle. And then the third, you're really getting the stale air out. And it's more forceful exhalation. Then you do the right, same progression again, block off, and then exhale very gently. You're exhaling the mental affliction of either hostility, aggression, or craving, attachment, depending on whether you're man or woman. And then the second exhalation will be a little more forceful, the third then the most forceful, getting the most subtle residue. And then the last of the nine rounds, you breathe in through both nostrils, and then you exhale up the central channel, and then basically out the third eye, the Ajna chakra here. It comes out both nostrils, obviously, but you visualize that it's going up the central channel and out here through your forehead. And that is exhaling and purging what Trungpa Rinpoche said is doubt and apathy and confusion. So that's the first of the progression. Do this nine round breathing. Then the second, right after you finish that, you then let your diaphragm expand, your abdomen expand fully, and breathe in very gently, but with a full breath. And this is then we move on to a technique called vase breathing. And this is different than vase breathing technique, which is associated with Tummo or Chandali practice, which is a much more assertive, aggressive, tense posture and, a lot more going on in it. This is very, very gentle. So you inhale and you bring the air all the way down to your abdomen. And you visualize that the air is just coming all the way down to your abdomen. And it's called vase breathing because it's like your abdomen is a vase and you're filling the air down there. And then you hold the breath and you gently push it down. So there's another, if you're totally at the beginning, you might not have the kind of the muscle control to experience all of it. But there feels like after you get used to it, like there's another muscle closer to the backbone. It's probably involved with developing Nauli and those other really wild things. But that you can just use that to kind of push very gently the air down right in the bottom there. So you gently push it down, and then you hold your breath for just as long as it's comfortable. So so you never want to feel like you're out of breath, but it's just very gentle, and you push it down. So in these techniques, there are always two things that are going on. There's what you're doing, and then what you're knowing. And so what you're doing is you are holding the breath and pushing it down into the vase. But what you are really knowing as you're doing that is still spaciousness of the mind when the breath is suspended. And so you can certainly, and I have certainly experimented with this, talk your way right through it. you can just kind of continue the interior monologue that, and and not notice anything going on. And basically all you're doing is holding the breath and then you let it out very gently when you release it again. But you can just talk your way right through it and not notice anything going on. But if you just kind of set that aside, the talking aside, what you notice is that, wow, there is something really profound happening here, in that there is a real profound stillness and spaciousness of awareness when the breath is suspended. And so what you're doing is you're creating this little vacuum of thought and movement. You're getting right into stillness instantly, simply because of this technique. So you can do this. You could do this for an entire 24-minute session. It's very, you know. So what I do then is exhale very, very gently and quietly. You know, you're not blowing it out. You just exhale quietly and then let the abdomen go in and out as you take two normal breaths, you know, and very, very relaxed. And then again, expand fully but slowly, and then do another one. And you can do that, you could do that, and I have done that for entire 24-minute sessions, or you can do it for a period, you know, of 3, 5, 7, just at the beginning, and or 12, or, you know, sometimes I often like to do this for like 12 minutes or so of a ghataka, because it just, if you are paying attention to the stillness, it just really, really, the pond goes calm very, very quickly. So that's the second of the techniques. And, you know, the lamas say that if this isn't for you, no big deal. You know, there are other techniques. But you might want to just try it out and see if it is for you. You know, you might think it's not for you, and it might actually be very beneficial. Then the third element in the progression, so you can, and often I would, in subsequent sessions then, I would skip the dispelling the stale air and just go right to vase breathing for a little while, and then go into the third one element in this progression, which is called gentle threefold breathing. And this then is basically, it's a very, very elementary pranayama, in that you are equalizing the inhalation, a retention, and the exhalation. So just those three elements. There's no retention after the exhalation. So you inhale, you know, and it, however long you inhale, you know, and it, you don't purposely try to, you know, make a 20-second inhale or something like that. It's just a, you know, normal inhale. And then you retain for the same length of time that it takes to inhale, and then you exhale for the same amount of time of the previous two. So all three of these are the same length of time, same duration. And what you really notice there is that having that pranayamic pause of the retention between the inhalation and the exhalation really helps you to define what the inhalation is and how it's so different from the exhalation, because there's normally we just, you know, go right through from inhalation to exhalation without, and it just all becomes really blurry, that there's no boundary between them. And so what are you doing? So there are two elements to these practices. What are you doing? You're equalizing the inhalation and exhalation and retention for the same duration. And then what are you knowing? When you are inhaling, you know that you're inhaling. When you are exhaling, you know that you're exhaling. So this is the critical and most important part of this technique, is that you simply know when you're breathing in that you're breathing in. You know when you're breathing out that you're breathing out. And this becomes really, really powerful. support for, again, stilling the mind. And then you have that period of tranquility again, you know, when the breath is suspended, that you can notice that it, when the breath is not moving, the mind is not moving. So those are, I think of those as preliminary, all three of those as preliminaries. And then in subsequent sessions, it might just be the two preliminaries, or it could be just the last one would be a preliminary to practice. So you can just kind of play around with it and see, you know, how far back you need to go, basically, to start the whole process again. So these are all techniques for getting hold of it, or grasping the mind through breathing. Settling the mind when the mind hasn't settled, using the techniques of breathing. And the purpose of all three of these groups of techniques, with a focus, without a focus, and with breathing, is to develop a state of the mind in which the mind naturally comes to rest. So that's the whole point of all three of these groups of techniques, is just to bring the mind naturally to rest. And that is like, again, the metaphor is like a vast body of water that is perfectly still. And then the key is also that it is during the day, not during the night. So it is perfectly tranquil, but it is illuminated. So you have this balance of stability and clarity. And so that is the natural state that we are trying to rest in, is this balance of stability and clarity. And all of these techniques are intended to bring us to rest in that. And then the two things that are preventing us from experiencing this stability and clarity right now are the two major problems in shamatha practice. All the way through from level 1 to level 9, it's basically these, you know, more and more subtle manifestations of either excitation or laxity or distraction and dullness. But basically these families, you either have too much energy or too little energy. But basically with either one of these, what you're doing is that you have lost the present moment of experience. You've lost your object, your focal support, or the true object, and your mind has gone wandering, or it is beginning to fall asleep. So these are the two, you know, ditches. If mindfulness is trying to keep us, you know, on the center of the road, the two ditches that we can go off into would be excitation on the left and laxity and dullness on the right. And so what we need to develop, the two things that we really need to develop in order to stay on the road and out of, and to eliminate excitation and laxity, are mindfulness and introspection. And here, a lot of the things that kind of came to me intuitively in my practice over the last couple of years, it's really gratifying to see that they're really confirmed explicitly in these practices, and Trungpa Rinpoche and the Ninth Karmapa say exactly kind of what came to me that I hadn't had teachings on, or kind of teachings that weren't real teachings. So the definition of mindfulness here in Mahamudra is really interesting. So mindfulness, remember in most of the classic definitions, is recollection or remembering. And so what you are doing, mindfulness really begins with intention. Trungpa Rinpoche says this. So mindfulness begins with intention. So you determine to either do something or not do something. So intention. And you know that it's very possible to sit down to meditate and never have an intention to do anything, and your mind just kind of wanders through the whole session. So the very critical thing is to have a very clear intention. And then the mindfulness here is defined as recalling or remembering your intention. What is it that you are intending to do, or what is it that you are intending not to do? So this is really interesting and a very subtle point, but I think very important, because a lot of times I think we just come to think that mindfulness is on the object. I am mindfully, so Lama Allen translates this as bearing in mind, you know, which works perfectly here. You're bearing in mind your intention, but you're not really bearing in mind the object. You're bearing in mind your intention. And there, it's a really important distinction, because then what you're doing is just allowing. So Lama Tsongkhapa describes intention as being like a magnet that is drawing iron filings. You know, and it's under this force of intention that iron filings are brought into a pattern or drawn to the magnet. So what you're doing is just allowing awareness to know the object rather than mindfulness. As Sokchen Ponlop said, what we don't want to do is to squeeze the object with mindfulness, to think that mindfulness is holding on to and grasping the object. So you start with intention, then you're remembering what your intention is continually. You know, it's continual mindfulness of what is my intention, what is my intention, what is my intention. You know, and you don't have to say it verbally, but it's recalling. And then introspection is the capacity of awareness that knows whether you actually are doing what you intended to do or not. So mindfulness is the remembering of your intention, and then introspection is the quality control to let you know how you're actually doing with your intention or not. So it seems to me that this is really simplifies again everything, that you really focus on the intention. What it is that you're doing, remember your intention, and then just check in to see how you're doing. And what you're doing is bearing in mind your intention. So, and then the second phase of practice. So we, first of all of that is settling the mind that has not settled. And then the second phase of practice is stabilizing the mind that has settled. So really, the whole focus of stabilizing the mind, what you're doing, is developing mindfulness and introspection, and of course intention, because intention really in this way is really kind of rolled into mindfulness. But it starts, mindfulness first of all, of course, has to start with intention. So I think of it as a three-step process of intention, mindfulness, or remembering the intention, and then introspection. So you're basically, after you learn the techniques for settling the mind that has not settled with breath, meditation, etc., then all that you're doing in the second part for stabilizing the mind that has settled is just developing your mindfulness and introspection. And that's really about it. And there's are a couple of techniques for that as antidotes to laxity and dullness, or to laxity and excitation, that I'll get into tomorrow. And again, this text, or these three texts of the ninth Karmapa, are basically all learning techniques for getting the mind to settle in its natural state. And so here, what I was doing these breath practices in my, you know, in repeated sessions, and doing, first of all, and especially focusing on vase breathing, and then the three-part breathing, and keeping in mind that the real object is the natural stillness of the mind, something, the progression led to something that seemed to just happen naturally, and it was like, oh God, this is it. this really works. So two more elements then in this progression, which are would be familiar to those of you who have studied with Lama Allen, which he calls Dzogchen approach to mindfulness of breathing, or very, very similar anyway. So the next element then, so after you do these three pranayamas or two pranayamas, the next, and remember that the what you are knowing when you are doing vase breathing is knowing that when you're not breathing, there is this natural stillness, spacious stillness of the mind. And you have an experiential knowing of that. And then what you are knowing in the gentle threefold breathing is you are knowing that when I am breathing in, you know that you're breathing in, and when you breathe out, you know that you're breathing out. So what this just led me to naturally was giving up all control of the breath then, which is a primary component of Lama Allen's approach to teaching breath meditation, that you don't try to constrain the breath or force it into a pattern of pranayama, even though that's just what we did as preliminaries. You give up all control of the breath and let the body breathe itself, and the breath settles into its natural state. So that what I noticed right away when experimented with giving up all control of the breath is that you might settle into a rhythm that you would never settle into if you were controlling the breath. Because a lot of meditation instruction that I've had over, you know, the first 20 years especially, was that you do kind of pranayama-like things where you equalize the inhalation and exhalation, for instance, and that the breath would become long. And this is like, you know, yoga teacher counting the breath, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, exhale, 1. You know, and so we can kind of consciously or unconsciously think that this is what a stable breath cycle is, a long breath cycle. But when you give up all control of the breath, what you might notice, you know, what I've really noticed, and it happens really quickly when you switch from the gentle threefold breathing where you are equalizing the inhalation, retention, and exhalation, you give up all control of the breath. And what I notice is that right away, very, very quickly, I settle into a short, shallow rhythm of the breath. So the Buddha, in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 10,000 stanzas, said, and this is his pith instruction really for Anapanasati, the breath meditation, you know. He says, Shariputra, take the analogy of a potter or a potter's apprentice spinning the potter's wheel. If he makes a long revolution, he knows it is long. If he makes a short revolution, he knows it is short. Shariputra, similarly, a bodhisattva, a great being, mindfully breathes in and mindfully breathes out. If the inhalation is long, he knows the inhalation is long. If the exhalation is long, he knows the exhalation is long. If the inhalation is short, he knows the inhalation is short. If the exhalation is short, he knows the exhalation is short. So that's it. You know when you're breathing in that you're breathing in, and you know whether it's relatively long or whether it's relatively short. But it is really immediate, non-conceptual knowing of the breath. So you know whether it's long or short, you give up all control, you allow the breath to find its own rhythm, and you might find then that you settle into this very short, shallow rhythm. But regardless of what it is, whether the breath is long or short, whatever rhythm that you settle into as you have given up control of the breath. So you could say here, what are you doing? You are giving up control of the breath and letting the body breathe itself. What are you knowing? When you breathe in, you know you're breathing in. When you breathe out, you know you're breathing out. And that, when, you know, after having done these, the progression of pranayamas, when you get to that point, it feels weird. It feels so light, so spacious, so easy, so stable. But light and spacious, really. I mean, it's like, I can do this for a long time. This is, and so you do that. You settle into how simple can it get? When you breathe in, you know you're breathing in. When you breathe out, you know you're breathing out. And then you know, kind of peripherally just know, well, now this is getting really short and shallow. So the reason that I mentioned that is just don't freak out and think, oh, this, I'm doing it wrong because my breath is getting short and shallow and it's supposed to be long and deep. You know, we just have this association. Relaxation should be a long, deep breath. But relaxation is actually short and shallow, just like deep dreamless sleep is. So Lama Allen has this hypothesis that is quickly borne out when you look at your experience, that it settles into the cycle of 4 seconds per breath. 2 seconds for an inhalation, 2 seconds for an exhalation. So 15 cycles per minute. And if you do the math, it turns out to be 21,600 breaths if you were to do that for 24 hours, which is exactly what the Guhya Samaja Tantra says is the number of breaths that we take during a day, 21,600. And that's really a short, shallow cycle of breath. So the reason that I mention that is not that you should aim for that, but don't freak out or be disturbed or think that you're doing it wrong if you just naturally end up there at very short, shallow. And you probably, you know, if you had been doing meditation focused on the movement of the abdomen, you probably will still notice a very subtle movement of the abdomen, even though you're just breathing kind of with the top of your lungs. And that is just so, feels very, very stable and spacious. And then, so that's 4 elements in the progression. And then the 5th is that it just feels so natural then when you do that for a period of time and you're just kind of in this light, spacious state of knowing the breath, to just let the knowing of the rhythm of the breath sink into the background altogether. And what you're left with is cognitive luminosity or luminous cognizance, awareness of awareness. You're left with just still spacious awareness. And it is just like the most reliable, for me, it's like become the most reliable, quickest way to get into that stillness, awareness of awareness, using this progression of pranayamas, giving up control of the breath, and you're just kind of left where there with this just natural arising of what is the true object of Mahamudra Shamatha practice. So that was a lot. Let's take a 6-minute break and then we'll come back and do that. Of course, I went over a half hour, so we won't get 3 sessions later, but we'll get 2 that you'll actually be able. So we'll do a guided session when we come back. I'll guide you through this whole progression. And then we'll take another 6-minute break after that. And then you'll have 2 silent ghatakas before lunch to do whatever breath meditation that you want. You know, but I would recommend that you do breath meditation. So if you have a favorite breath meditation, you can do that, you know, focused on the nose. Oh, I forgot to mention one that the ninth Karmapa also, and you see this emphasized in a lot of the texts, counting the breath. So you have an option of doing that also. So you can basically, the ninth Karmapa said you can count. So the natural time to do that is in the brief pause after the inhalation. So inhale, count very briefly, punctuate it, don't draw it out and, you know, drone all the way through the exhalation, because then you're just learning, you know, proving that you can count. But you just are keeping track of the breath, you know, mindful of the breath by counting it. And he says you can start with 21 and work up to 100,000. And if you, 100,000, if we're doing 21,600 a day, you know, that's like 5 days worth of counting your breath. And but one of the texts says that if you're able to do 100,000, you'll add 5 years to your lifespan. So it might be worth it. So just that. So you can do whatever breath meditation you want for those final two gatikas then. And or you can just experiment on your own with what you were going to do in the next session. So we'll take a 6-minute break, and let's just at 10:40, we'll come back and start that.